Good morning, it's 12 o'clock, and it's time for the Women's Consciousness-Raising Hour. I'm Diane Trombley. Over the last month, we've been bringing you tapes of programs from the Bicentennial Women's Center. Today, we'll be hearing a poetry reading done by three women, Rosemary Capello, Barbara Ruth, and Marion Cohen. But first, let's hear a song called The Talking Wanted by Virgo Rising. It's from their album, The Once and Future Woman.
Looking for a man to wash my clothes and iron my shirts and blow my nose and sweep the floor and wax the kitchen while I sit playing guitar and bitching. Mud all over my boots, feet up on the table, just doing my thing. Oh, I'm looking for a guy who'll cook my meals and wash my dishes and take the peels off my bananas with a grin and ask me how my work day's been. Terrible as always. Playing the guitar is such a struggle. Well, I'm looking for a guy with curly hair and great big muscles and a nice derriere who'll get up nights and feed the baby and bring my coffee when I'm ready. I gotta feel good in the morning. That's when I make my best music. So if you feel you'd like to apply, well, just send a photo or come on by and you can shine my shoes today. And if you're lucky, I'll let you stay and cook supper. And after you've finished the dishes, I might even let you listen to me play the guitar.
Now we'll hear the tape. The first poet is Rosemary Capello.
Our first poet is Rosemary Capello. She's published over 75 poems, read at places such as the Northeast Regional Library, Small Press Book Fair, WUHY radio station, Walt Whitman Graveyard Party. She's read on the Parkway this summer, et cetera, et cetera. Rosemary Capello.
Thank you, ma'am. Every time I give a reading, I like to center it around a particular theme. And tonight, I chose the theme of letters. It's a subject that's especially dear to me. I like to write letters. I love to receive them. And I guess you could say I started my writing career through writing letters. My sisters entered the convent when I was 15 years old, and that's when I began. All these letters that gradually evolved into articles and poetry. And it was the first inkling that I had that people liked my writing because they weren't allowed to answer, nor were they allowed to come home. Of course, the order has since liberalized the rules. But when I went to visit them, and also their mail was censored, the superior told me she liked the letters that she would read them to the whole community. So naturally, this did a great deal for my 15-year-old ego, and I said I'm a writer, and I just took it from there. I guess I've written to just about everybody over the years. I love to write letters, and I write to politicians when they do something right. I write to them when they do something wrong. I write to names and faces, stories, people behind the stories that appeal to me. But there was a time in my life when I became somewhat depressed. And during this time, I didn't read or write. I didn't do these things that I loved. And this first poem that I'm going to read is written down myself. And it's written in the third person because at the time I wrote it, I had a critic who told me that I wrote too much. And I think it's effective, more effective advice today. Can anyone hear me? It is untitled. She told me the years spent withdrawn were wall-piercing, lung-crushing from the pressure of nothing. It all began because she wanted to start over, get to the bottom of her brain. A dangerous game she does not recommend to anyone afraid of facing the dark side. If she stayed unbled, it was no thanks to the living, with their limited offers of food, drink, a fix, or a good screw. Only the dead spoke at first, but she could not stay one-celled forever. Had to learn what to do with real people, grew tougher skin, and one day took her second first breath. From an analyst's couch, I am not like most housewives. I do not keep house well. The walls of my house sag. Its windows are broken. Its floors stick to the feet. Its furniture lies buried under books. Its children must not disturb me because I have to write love letters all day. I am not like most housewives. Shall I tell you how I spend my day? Blackbirds bite me awake from dreams of death. I start to work, catching apples that roll from the painting on the wall. I'm hungry, but these apples are too live to eat. Mischievous fruit make me chase them. I can't stop laughing, neither can Cezanne. Outside, people exhaust the air. I must neglect these apples if I'm to accomplish anything. Water draws me where the creek runs through the city's core. It drowns out human hammerings with the sound of its cool cauldron boil. Trees slide down its banks. Red mites run on my white page, afraid of the afternoon moon. An artist misses a tree heavy with dripping cankerberries. An alarm reminds me I must forget who I am if I'm to remember who I am. I return to sleep. One of my favorite writers of prose was John Updike, and he has a book of short stories called Beck, a Book. And in that collection, there's a story called The Bulgarian Poetess, and it tells of how a man goes overseas for the State Department, and he meets a lot of foreign writers over there. He comes to like this Bulgarian poetess very much. They have a real rapport. Unfortunately, nothing can come of this. And their last meeting is very hurried. They don't even get to speak to each other alone. It's in a crowded room like at a press conference. And he just has enough time to hand her his book, and he has inscribed on it, "My only regret is that you live on one side of the world and I the other." Well, of course, I identified with this Bulgarian poetess very strongly, since John Updike made her look so good and liked her so much and everything. And I wrote a poem and sent it to John Updike, and he's one of those who never responded. It's called "For John Updike from the Bulgarian Poetess." I come not to disturb your morning quiet, but to further it, to deepen its dark beauty with white. You have studied the six sides of my snowflake. You have not mistook me for an empty drop. Do not regret the space between us. We are one. This next poem I wrote for all the people who say they don't have time to answer letters, because I think that's an insult. I think we all find time to do the things we want to do. This day, apparently so alive with summer sound, is dead. Life has become no more than dull routine. The world is full of busy people. Death stares from a vacant dress, no one to wear it. The name I was born to is Petrarca, and my father used to like to say that perhaps we were descendants of the great Italian poet Petrarch. He said throughout the centuries the second R might have somehow been lost, and I used to think that this was just wishful thinking until I read a biography of Petrarch, and I saw that he was a person quite similar to my father and myself. He loved gatherings of literary people, and he loved people, and he loved nature, and he wrote a lot of letters, and people also wrote to him. And I write to a lot of poets also. One of the poets I write to is Ann Menabroker in California. And I was struck by the similarity of an excerpt from a letter Boccaccio wrote to Petrarch with an excerpt that Ann Menabroker wrote to me. Another thing I'd like to say is, when I saw that Boccaccio and Petrarch were friends, I was very much surprised, because Boccaccio was a writer of risque prose, whereas Petrarch wrote lyrical poetry. And this warmed my heart because I sometimes get a little annoyed with the different schools of poetry that are intolerant of each other. Boccaccio wrote this letter after he had been to Petrarch's house. Letter from Boccaccio to Petrarch, 1349. You are devoting yourself to the study of sacred authors, and I, being eager to own copies of your writings, was making copies of them. When evening came, we rose together from our labors and went into your little garden, which was beautiful with the leaves and flowers of early spring. And we sat talking together quietly and on worthy themes until day had passed into night. Excerpt from letter from Anne Menebroker to Rosemary Capello, 1976. When you mentioned Paul Ferracano's name, I let out a yelp of happiness. Paul is a wonderful young poet with a gorgeous young wife who came up here last January to a great party I gave that was great due to the marvelous guest and stayed the night. Oh, Rosie, there can be such good vibes in the world, and yet the days get bogged down with such mundane things so often. Anne Menebroker has been active in the poetry scene in California for the past 20 years. As editor, poet, and critic, she edits a little journal called Wine Rings, and she currently has a poem in an anthology called I Hear My Sister Saying, Poems by 20th Century Women. She once sent me a picture of her house and the area around it looked so desolate. As I looked at that picture, I began to wonder what kind of noises a person might hear at night there. So I wrote her a letter and I said, write a poem about the kind of noises you hear in Wilton, California at night. So she wrote me this poem. For Rosie, who wonders what kind of noises we hear at night in Wilton, by Anne Menebroker. What we hear is the night breathing and a soft metallic clank of bells placed around the necks of wandering cows. What we hear are incessant crickets and croaking frogs and all the dogs of the area howling in discordant harmony. What we hear are tires screeching black rubber on asphalt roads without sidewalks, sirens in the night, a phone ringing in a strange slumbering hour, a turning of someone next to us. What we hear is the offering of tomorrow and the wind that whistles through the now grown pine trees. What we hear are the droning engines of planes in our dreams. What we hear are all the night noises and spaces of Wilton and the light coming from the east. When I received that poem, I was struck with the similarity to our own Derby noises. So I wrote a poem for Annie. Some Derby night sounds are same as Wilton's. Dog barks, sirens, crickets, and assorted mating calls, but no cowbells. The moon, if you look at it long enough, makes a sound, as do the stars. The moon hums an ancient chant, warm and comforting. The stars sing high. If it is hot, as in this August night, not a wind stirs. If the phone rings, it scares me. No one calls this time of night, except the heavy breather. I wonder who he is. Someone, I guess, who finds no comfort in the moon. I also have a correspondence with a poet in California named Joan Smith. And I brought one of her letters along because this is an example of the kind of letter she sends. She sent me a sprig of spearmint from her garden with instructions that it's good for everything from colic and gas. And it's also an excellent local application for piles. I never knew that about spearmint. And she has excellent handwriting because she's an artist, and her letters are visually beautiful because she prints them all in this beautiful print of hers. And I wrote a poem about Joni's letters. Joni sends me letters and pieces of California life small enough to fit in envelopes. A menu from a restaurant where poets meet. Charles Bukowski's autograph. Eucalyptus twigs and manzanita. pictures of the people she loves. When she gives all these a second and more lasting life in words, Joni sends me poems. And in this particular letter, she sent me 3 poems, and I'm going to read one of them now. One thing that Joan Smith and I have in common, happy memories of our fathers. And this poem is called As Sweet As That. When she was in a good mood because my dad had come home early for supper and told her her biscuits and honey tasted as good as his mother's, or because he'd said he'd take us to see Forever Amber, the movie she'd been wanting to see, she would sing while we did dishes, her washing, me drying, and she would whistle too, and I'd get embarrassed. "Why don't you ever sing?" she'd ask me. And I'd say, "I don't know." And she'd tell me about being young like me, but a little older, and how she used to meet my father at the town square after she'd done the dishes. And all of them would sing and dance while my father and some of the others played their guitars. And they'd do the jig and the shuffle. And my father would lay down his guitar and do a tap dance, careful not to get his white shoes and trousers dirty. And when the sun went down, they'd all sit in the park and watch the fireflies flitting in the cottonwood trees. And I think to myself, putting away the dinner dishes, how I'd never be able to sing as sweet as that. This next letter is an example of a letter. Well, it's not an example, it's an actual excerpt of a letter I sent to someone who was remiss in answering. "Dear, I hope you are feeling fine this beautiful April day. My garden is alive with several varieties of flowers. Pansies, grape hyacinths, periwinkle, mountain pinks. Everything except Chinese hibiscus and orchids, which I really crave. Did you ever see a Chinese hibiscus? It is an enormous, crepe papery red flower with interesting insides. In Pennsylvania, it is called a houseplant, for it couldn't bear our outdoors in winter. However, to call it a mansion plant is more like it, for the smallest one ever seen by me was 4 feet tall, 3 feet wide, and growing. And my mail is alive, with letters from poets sending poems, lovers of poetry asking for poems, bills, traffic tickets, reports from missionaries and other such stuff. But no word, either by U.S. mail or Beltel, from you. Is that any way to keep a friendship going?" Well, the letter did the trick, and I received the reply. And I wrote to this person again on Mother's Day. I find that I write mostly when I'm very happy and I have great news to share, or even good news. "Dear, I was glad to hear from you on Friday. In fact, I'm still glad about it today. Mother's Day is quite a beautiful day, weather-wise and otherwise. My children gave me orchids and baby's breath and candy. My husband gave me money. A young woman who likes me brought me a half gallon of good wine. An old friend who moved far away came to see me. An old friend who now has a ranch in California just called me. All very pleasant surprises. First thing this morning, I had a phone call from a poet I've helped. He was emotionally upset and hospitalized for a time. He is feeling better now and credits his recovery to me and the people he's met through me. I guess I should have told him. He did it himself. But I just stood there and took the credit. My sister in Maryland also called me today, and my other sister from Maryland was here yesterday. I jokingly call myself the mother of the world. And the above facts seem to substantiate that with all these long-lost friends and relatives contacting me on Mother's Day. I am not leaving the house today, for I'd better wait around and see what other goodies are going to come my way, and while waiting, savor those that already have. It occurs to me that I haven't given you any presents lately. Actually, I'm not much of a gift giver. I hate the way some holidays have become orgies of present exchanging. A gift can be a good and enduring token of one's affection, but most often isn't. But written in times of thinking affection, I have given you and you must. passage down the good corridors as well as the bed. This next poem is called From One Philatelist to Another. My daughter tells me it's pronounced philatelist. I don't know the proper pronunciation, but it's a stamp collector. It's raining, too gutsy to go out in, so I'm staying home studying my stamp collection. I've got doubles of Frank Lloyd Wright on the two center. Trade you for a George Washington one center. Gee, you can learn a lot from stamps. Here's Indian Chief Joseph, colorfully garbed on a six center. And the poor buffalo. First we slaughtered him, then we presented him bleak and morose on postage. Did you know Susan B. Anthony looked like Whistler's mother? Thomas Paine had a stylus nose. Nebraska is noted for cows and corn. And according to John Trumbull, the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought by swashbucklers. So much for American commemoratives. Did you know the Vietnamese play an instrument that looks like the bongo, gracefully? There are wild boars in Bhutan, white ibises in Burundi, and the Urals mines glow amethyst and topaz. Still, there are two simple facts I don't know. How you are, and if you care for me, for none of these stamps brought me letters. The next poem is like my Bon Voyage poem. For a traveler to Sicily, some souvenirs that would suit me. Don't barter over burnished bracelets of brass for me. Bring me ardent air of mountainsides I'll never see, some algae spray, and nubs of naked rock that are your home. For someone who makes an adolescent of me, damn you, too many images of you pursue me since you called to say goodbye. It was good when you were just 5 1/8 miles away, but now you've gone and traveled 20,000 light years off, and all I have of you are ghost movie reels, phantom tape cassettes, and enough warmth to say damn you with a smile. Letter to a vacationing lover. Lucky for you, you're absent from July. Too green, too wet, too smoldering, full of redundant thunder and lightning that leaves me uncharged. Now we get into anger, which can be most invigorating. I wrote this poem after I read a review in the Sunday Bulletin of a book that was written by a woman who supports the feminist movement. And the man who wrote this book review did not review the book. He reviewed this woman, and in a most derogatory manner. I wanted to write to him directly, but I didn't, because I guess I was in one of my cynical moods. I thought, well, he'll only throw the letter in the wastebasket and file my name with the members of the lunatic fringe. So I thought, well, instead of writing to him, I will write a poem directed at all the men I know who have said the same thing he has said. Guys, you disgust me when you react to news of feminists by saying they grew up wanting to be like their fathers. You think it would have been better had they grown up wanting to be like their mothers. They should have studied eagerly the art of spending one's day in the narrowness of the family cell, till, like their mothers, they would have no corner of their minds left open for people or ideas outside their homes. They dare to call themselves members of the human race, like their fathers. And this deprives you of the freedom to muss their hair, chuck their cheeks, and stay on top. I guess the next couple are like unrequited love. Written while drinking Beaujolais alone. You asked, is Monday night all right? And I said, fine, went out and bought your favorite wine, full of things I don't need, calories, sad songs, and visions of you before you knew me well enough to be unkind. The next poem is titled, I'm sorry you returned my book. I like to think of it sitting on your desk where you might glance at it and remember. I hope you don't expect me to return the necklace you gave me, because I'm keeping it when I'm not wearing it in a bureau drawer next to an old gold watch and a sapphire ring that belonged to my grandmother. In the next poem, there's three Italian words, addio senza rancor. I'm smiling because I pronounce Italian very poorly. I have a mental block against it. But if I go into that, I'll take up too much time. So anyway, those three words mean... I've become so used to talking to a tape recorder, it's terrible. But anyway, they mean farewell without hatred or bitterness. And Puccini, in one of his beautiful operas, has an aria, too, that begins, addio senza rancor. Letter to a dead. Dear, I feel I am saying dear to a complete stranger. I wanted to know you, but you wouldn't let me. And what I do know about you, I don't want to know. That sounds drunk, but I'm sober. That sounds like something I shouldn't tell you, but I'm reckless. I wanted this to be an addio senza rancor letter, but my blood runs both ways. Well, that's enough of the more unpleasant side. I spoke up a friendship with a poem, with a poet, through the mail. Oh, I have a lot of friends who are poems also, but this one happens to be human. He is like a human poem. And he invited me to his house for lunch, and I went. And he's the lover of nature, and it was quite a beautiful afternoon. And when I went home, I started to write him a thank you note, and the thank you note became this poem. Nature, welcoming, told us in the gentle wave of pine limbs bearing tiny cones, ivy scampered to the crest of an unbothered oak, and coarse-leaf spike chestnut branches, that we did not intrude. In this atmosphere of warmth that dispelled the ungodly heat of mid-July, you shared with me photographs of distant dreams and instant iced tea from an antique pitcher under the sound of nuthatches, breeze-blown leaves, and muffled thunder. When my father died, he left behind a great deal of writing, which I took to my house and have been trying to edit. And he also wrote quite a few letters, quite a lot of letters. A lot of them he never sent out because English was not his native language, and he always felt he wasn't using the most proper English. And so he would make the rough drafts and try to correct them and just not send them usually in the end. And also he was very emotional, and sometimes if he would say he was writing a letter to one of my sisters in the convent, we would tell him, you can't send them that because that's too sad. And so most of his letters he never sent. And so I found among his letters one that he had written to my daughter, which he did send after she had given him a box of chocolate-covered cherries. Dear Mimi, I am writing a few phrases to thank you for your delicious and most welcome cherry gift. Due to the stubbornness of age, my teeth are unwilling to chew sweetness, and I usually am forced to look and not enjoy such delicacy. But now I am going to dissolve the candies in my coffee, making a chocolate drink adorned with pretty cherries. My final poem is one that I wrote for another person that I write to, even though he lives in the same town I do, Darby. We see each other, and we also write long letters to each other. He writes mainly short stories. And his letters are wonderfully humorous. So I wrote this poem, Charlie's Letters. You write a nice letter, Charlie. Not the kind one reads and folds and tosses on the desk and throws away at cleaning. When I am falling, I reach for your notes. Your words, so full of the humor your gut manages, though your eyes deny, till, caught up in the smoky scent your letters are soaked in, I get high. That's all.
Thanks, Rosemary.
Our next poet is Barbara Ruth. She's published somewhere around 150, 200 we stopped counting poems, stories, etc. She's read at the Jewish Y, Painted Bride, Alexandria Bookstore, on the radio. She just had some poems read on TV. She's the author of a book of poetry, Contractions, which I've mentioned earlier. And a second book of poetry of hers will be published by Seven Woods Press. She's on the Governor's Council of Sexual Minorities. Too much. There's a lot of things. Other things I could say, go on and on. We'll let her speak for herself.
Mary, I'm going to hire you as a press agent. I don't think that was all true, but it all sounded good. Jeff Ashton. Where is it comfy? Everybody has a seat that she wants now. Sisters, this is my one, my only life. I stand here before you. I show you my wounds. Sisters, I may be dead tomorrow. We may all die without having touched. I admit it. I'm insatiable. I can never get enough woman love.